Amy, on this podcast, we try to always offer useful takeaways. And if you learn nothing else from us, learn this useful parenting lesson by Pampers Cruisers 360.
Pampers Cruisers 360 are the ultimate parent hack, the best diaper to use as soon as your baby starts standing or walking. Instead of ordinary diaper tabs, they have a unique 360-degree stretchy waistband that moves with your wild child.
Pampers Cruisers 360 makes it so easy to change your baby. Who probably doesn't stop moving just because they need a diaper changed? Just slide on to apply and away they go.
And fear not, parents. Pampers Cruisers 360 offers an up to 100% leak-free fit. And they just got even better with a new blowout barrier. Need we say more?
For trusted protection, trust Pampers, the number one pediatrician recommended brand. Download the Pampers Club app today and earn Pampers cash. Then redeem your Pampers cash for exclusive Pampers coupons, savings, and rewards.
Only redeemable via Pampers Club. Pampers cash has no cash value. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Fresh Take from What Fresh Hell, Laughing in the Face of Motherhood. This is Amy. And today, I'm talking to Kelly Coleman. Kelly is a feature film development executive turned author and advocate for parent caregivers and individuals with disabilities. Kelly's writing and advocacy draws upon over a decade of experience accessing the necessary supports for children with disabilities to succeed, including her own child. Kelly lives in Los Angeles with her husband, her two boys, and her son's trusty service dog. Today, we're going to talk about Kelly's new book, Everything No One Tells You About Parenting a Disabled Child, Your Guide to the Essential Systems, Services, and Supports. Welcome, Kelly.
Thank you so much for having me. I love not only your community, but just the permission to laugh at all of the stuff, because there's a lot of stuff.
We like to say there's always a thing and a thing. And
and a thing about the thing.
Right. So that's what this book is about. That's what we're going to start talk about today. So let's start by having you tell us a little bit about your own story about parenting a disabled child and how that came to be for you.
Mm-hmm. So I have two amazing kiddos, 10 and 12. Our older son, who is not disabled, he's in a rock band and plays the tuba and does magic and like all the things that a typical 12-year-old would do. And he's very close with his younger brother, Aaron, who's 10 years old and has all of his own things, whether it's watching airplanes or loving swimming or being the mayor of Trader Joe's. Aaron also has multiple disabilities and what that looks like for him. He has an undiagnosed genetic syndrome and within that, subdiagnoses that include autism, epilepsy, cerebral palsy, microcephaly, cortical vision impairment, feeding tube, sensory, gross motor, fine motor, cognitive. Like, he's like, I'm just going to check all the boxes. So he's an overachiever. And we started, you know, of course, with our first son, he was, if you were to, you know, read an article of what an easy baby looks like, that would be our first son. And we're clearly it was because we were such great parents because we just had it all figured out and we were just doing everything right. Or it was just because he was an easy baby. I think that's a big part of it.
Right.
And then our second kid came along and we're like, we got this, man. We've got it all figured out. And then very quickly, we're like, oh, we actually have nothing figured out, which can happen with any parenting experience.
Well, that's true. Any second child, right. We'll be like, oh, I thought I knew how babies were and I only knew how one baby was. Right.
Yes. Yeah. And as soon as we're certain we have it figured out, the universe is like, oh, no, this is not how this is going to work. So our version of this is not how this is going to work was that from day one, I knew something was going on, but there was no evidence to support it other than the intuition. And by the time Aaron was 3 months old, we were hospitalized because he was eating almost nothing. We had determined with a specialist by that point that he had cortical vision impairment, which means physiologically everything is behaving as it should, but cognitive processing, his brain didn't know what to do with the images. So he was literally blind at that point. And his progress on that front is, our doctor describes as almost unheard of because now he has a tremendous amount of functional vision. And when your kid is undiagnosed, you kind of don't know what the trajectory is, but you do know there's a lot of paperwork and figuring out and reinventing all the wheels, which reinventing all the wheels has been a a common theme of our parenting experience.
So, you know, you talk about the sort of reinventing the wheel that has to happen when you're parenting a disabled child. And so this book, part of your reason for writing the book, it seems to me, is to have these templates and to help parents. While no journey of a parenting a disabled child can ever be the same, there are certain things that are the same that you're going to have to do once or 100 times. And this book is full of templates for making those processes maybe a little easier for the next parent in line. So what are some of those processes in the book that you sort of lay out?
Yes. So the book is exactly that. It's the, we're all reinventing the same wheels, but there actually is so much that it's like, let's shortcut to figuring out what the right journey and the right systems are for you individually, depending on your family, your child, the disability, all the things. And so there, in the chapter on schools, there's a chapter for if you are visiting different schools, fill out this template, because here are all the things you're going to need to know, especially if you are arguing with the school district for one placement over another. There's a list of how to call 911, how to leave a message for a specialist office, what the heck to do when you're calling your insurance company.
Yes.
And how to actually get the things done, because no one knows this.
I took notes on this one. There's a whole section on insurance, definitions of things like what's a super bill, like these terms that they throw around and you don't even know what they are. You define them. But I loved this. The first thing that you need to say when you call the insurance office and get somebody on the phone is, what is your callback number in case we get disconnected? Like, that's right there on the template. Ask for that first. And the next thing is your reference number, so that when you get disconnected and they don't call you back and you get somebody else, you can start from where you left off instead of the beginning. Like, just having that in front of you when you call the insurance office must make it a little bit easier to get started.
Oh my goodness. To know like those things, to how to actually get it done and speak their language, and to know what your plan covers. I mean, talk about the epitome of what fresh hell is calling your insurance company, because it's always awful. And I'm not pretending, oh, it'll be fun once you read my book. No, but it will be doable and more productive and take way less time. And I was taking notes on the insurance chapter as I was writing this as well. And I've gotten insurance reimbursements so much faster. I'm like, oh, the book works. Okay, cool. Because it is so daunting, because everybody, whether you are financially planning for the future of a child who will not never be independent, whether it is the insurance company, disability rights and advocacy, getting a diagnosis, all of these different things. If we can start out with basic, real foundational knowledge that none of us know going into this, then we can be proactive instead of just reacting to everything. And I think that's part of the challenge of having a kid who is disabled. There is so much coming at you, you know, potentially with the disability, but certainly with the systems and the social services and the paperwork and the school, that you are just reacting to everything. And it is always exhausting. And the book is a way to turn that on its head, to say, like, here are the basics, so that you can actually be proactive. And you can kind of separate, here's what I can control, here's what I can't control, and actually feel good about and not dread doing these things that you actually can have some control over.
One of the things that I think you learn along the way parenting somebody with a disability is, you know, I'll speak from the experience that I have, seeking the diagnosis can feel like the most important thing that has to happen, right? To chase it. But sometimes that diagnosis is not coming, or it's not clear cut, or there's one thing that doesn't explain everything. And talk about that for you, because your child has so many different diagnoses and still, I think, some things that are not fully explained or understood, right? And so how has that worked for you, sort of accepting I'm going to chase the answers and the certainty, but also know when I might not be getting them and live with that?
So our son is an outlier amongst outliers. And as you said, he has all of these sub-diagnoses, which in and of themselves are a big deal. Epilepsy is a big deal. All the things that you have to know, all of this. And he's part of the Undiagnosed Diseases Network, which is this amazing network to try and bring diagnoses and put names to things. And we've done literally every test that science has available, and we still don't have an answer for the genetic component, which everyone on the team, including me, believes there is something there for us. And this varies understandably and absolutely with each family. Having that overall diagnosis doesn't cause us to lose sleep because he is doing well, he is making gains, he is on his own path and always will be. And a diagnosis very likely would not impact his treatment. And it would definitely have the potential to connect us with the community, which that I think is the most exciting thing. I would love for him to be surrounded by people, even if it's only one other human in the world at some point, who share the diagnosis with him. I know families for whom it is gut-wrenching and it is the thing that keeps them up at night, whether it is a genetic thing or whether it is my friend who I was crying with this weekend because she was so validated that she finally got her teenage daughter an autism diagnosis after years of gaslighting and people saying she couldn't possibly have autism because of X and Y and Z. And looking at presentations vary so widely, and diagnosis can be very important because it can equal access to services, whether that's social services, whether that is insurance, whether that is school programs. And because my son's disabilities are very clear, even without the overall genetic diagnosis, he has been able to access the services and supports that he needs. And I talk about accessing services a lot in the book. And for some people without that diagnosis, it is very hard to access the services, to be taken seriously, and to even really objectively view, oh, this is how my child's brain works. This is how they move through the world. And the diagnosis can help parents to really validate, like, oh, this is this hard to do homework because I'm doing this through the lens of my neurotype and my kid is doing it through the lens of their neurotype, and writing two sentences is taking 3 hours, not because they're unable to write a sentence, but because of how their brain is processing all of the things at the end of a very long day.
I'm talking to Kelly Coleman. Her new book is Everything No One Tells You About Parenting a Disabled Child. We'll be right back. Margaret, exciting news. I am about to have a new baby nephew. And believe it or not, this will be my 13th nephew.
Amy, you're ready to give up your amateur status. You're a pro aunt at this point.
Our family has seen a lot of babies. And as soon as they start standing or walking, I send them all a whole lot of Pampers Cruisers 360.
Pampers Cruisers 360 don't have ordinary diaper tabs. Instead, they have a unique 360-degree stretchy waistband that moves with your newly mobile little one.
Pampers Cruisers 360 offer a gap-free fit that is up to 100% leak-proof, crucial once your baby is quite literally up and at 'em. And that gap-free fit helps prevent your baby from taking off their diaper, a habit you do not want them to get into.
You can say that again. And Pampers Cruisers 360 just got even better with a new blowout barrier. Need we even elaborate on the need for that, friends? For trusted protection, trust Pampers, the number one pediatrician recommended brand.
Download the Pampers Club app today and earn Pampers Cash. Then redeem your Pampers Cash for exclusive Pampers coupon savings and rewards.
Only redeemable via Pampers Club. Pampers Cash has no cash value.
More and more, you hear about the importance of electrolytes as part of staying hydrated, because you need the sodium and the potassium, not just the water. And whether you're looking to hydrate during a workout, while traveling, or at the end of a long night, Sports Research Hydrate Electrolytes have got you covered with over 65 trace minerals, 7 essential vitamins, and coconut water powder.
Crisp and refreshing and without any sugar, this is hydration powered by Sports Research. They're little packets you can just grab and take with you to mix into your water bottle on the go. My favorite flavor so far, Amy, gotta be the cherry pomegranate.
Interesting. My high schooler likes the lemon lime, and she keeps a few handy in her backpack for days that she has practice after school. These electrolytes have the sodium and the potassium that you need to go with it in the optimal ratio for daily hydration.
Visit sportsresearch.com and use code WHATFRESH at checkout for 50% off your purchase of Hydrate.
That's Sports Research, SPORTSRESEARCH, sportsresearch.com, and use code WHATFRESH for 50% off your Hydrate electrolytes order. I wanted to talk to you, Kelly, about the language of disability. And how when you became the parent of a disabled child as a non-disabled person, that became one of the first things in your journey, one of the first things you had to learn. And I think a lot of us listening are still on that journey of like, am I supposed to say special needs? Am I supposed to say something else? I want to say the right thing and not the wrong thing, but I'm confused. So tell us why you use the language that you use and why the disabled community uses the language that it uses.
Mm-hmm. Thank you times a million for asking this. This is so important, and also important to not to acknowledge that we, and I'm guessing almost all, if not all of your listeners, grew up at a time where we tiptoed around the word disability because we were told that is bad. Don't say disabled.
Right.
Pretend that person's not there. Don't look. Don't stare. Ignore. I'm like, oh my gosh, please don't ignore my child. He doesn't want that. He wants to like wave at you and point out the carrots at the grocery store. When I first started writing this book, the word special needs was all over it. The big shift for me was talking to and being in conversation with and being in relationship with actual disabled people. The word disabled is not awkward to disabled people. It is the word that the community has chosen. And what I was told from, I interviewed over 40 experts for the book, very many of whom are disabled themselves, and talking about how the word disability is the word that is used in law, saying that my child is special or has different abilities or whatever the thing is, does not get him any protection or recognition under the law. So even from a like basic objective nuts and bolts standpoint, when I'm using the word disability, I'm claiming and allowing him to claim and supporting him in claiming the identity as part of the disability community, as someone who has protections under law. And I am taking the air out of the balloon of this ridiculous idea that we all grew up with, that disability is inherently bad. Shh, don't say it. Don't talk about it. Don't say that kid's disabled. Just pretend you don't see it. Like, trust me, you see my kid's disability. It's cool. And when I am using the word disability and I'm saying my son is disabled, I am not saying, oh, you poor thing, because disability is terrible. I'm also not saying, and he has superpowers. Like, he's a 10-year-old boy. Like, he wants to hang out with his friends. He thinks farts are funny. Like, he is a 10-year-old boy. And I am not putting any, like, oh, you're an inspiration on him because he's disabled. It is just an objective thing. I have talked to very many disabled adults, and not one has ever corrected me and said, I prefer special needs. It was very hard for me at first to really declare I am using the word disabled. And because it wasn't that I thought I had anything wrong with that, or I felt anything wrong with that word, but the internalized ableism that we all grew up with of like, oh, say he's special, don't say he's disabled, inherently is implying because disabled is bad.
Right. We just had Jessica McCabe on the show. She wrote a book called How to ADHD. And she uses the book, you know, she throughout the book is like, I have a disability. ADHD is a disability. I had the same conversation with her. And she said, you know, it's because I realized I was being ableist for myself and saying, like, I don't have that because that would be something bad if I did. And here I was missing out on services and supports that I was entitled to because I was afraid to use this very accurate word to describe what I was dealing with on a daily basis. So it makes so much sense that it makes things harder to not use the correct language.
Yes, it does. And also, it's interesting hearing people talk about the word disability and how it is used within disabled spaces. And, you know, talking to, for my book, the president and CEO of the American Association of Disabilities, of people with disabilities, and her saying, like, internalized ableism, we need to talk about that. people who, for example, are neurodivergent and they say, I'm not disabled. But the asterisk to that is, and you are still protected under federal law, even if you do not view your neurotype as a disability. And so I think empowering people to identify themselves as they feel is appropriate for them, and also recognizing you have this to lean on if accommodations and supports are not happening in a way that they need to be happening, because that is the disabling part, is these systems. So many people can function, quote unquote, typically within and including their disability, if it wasn't for all of these systems that are not accommodating in order for humans to just live their lives.
And when you have invisible disability, or your child does, right, this gets even more complicated. How do you help them own it, show up for it? At times when it might be easier to try to just sort of pass as, I don't need this extra accommodation, even when they really do. And then that's further complicated, I imagine, by being a non-disabled parent, helping your kid figure out what feels right for them in terms of owning their journey. Is your son probably a little bit too young to really think about how he wants to talk about himself or present his disability? But that moment comes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I believe that with my son in particular, his age as well as his cognitive disabilities play into it. And when I say he is intellectually disabled, also not a dig on my son, it's just a fact. He, I believe, is, and that's cool. Plenty of people are. So I love that you brought this up. The way that our family experiences disability, the way he experiences it when he is out in the world, is absolutely different in many ways from someone whose disabilities are not visible. It means you can't, you look at my kid and you're like, oh, you got a thing? Cool. Many people, I know so many friends whose children are not visibly disabled, and they get the, like, you need to ask your kid to be quiet, you're a terrible parent, the looks, the everything. And it's like, you know what? This music's real loud here at Old Navy. And of course he's having a moment. Like, so, and I've also, with the language piece, which I could just talk about all day, I am getting myself in the habit of saying non-visible disability instead of invisible because of disability rights activists I've spoken with who've said disability and disabled people have been made so invisible in our culture and made to feel invisible in our spaces. And that tiny shift of saying non-visible is important to many people I've talked to, which, again, I learned as I was writing the book because it had invisible in here. And Emily Liddell, who wrote a great book called Demystifying Disability, was my sensitivity reader for this. And she was like, yeah, no, here's why. And I was so appreciative of that. And when it is not clear to others that you or your child, your loved one, is disabled, you will get very different reactions, whether that is a challenge receiving a diagnosis, whether that is a doctor's office or classroom that refuses to be accommodating because they're speaking, they're walking, they're not disabled. Plenty of people are. And it's so messy being a non-disabled parent of a child with disabilities. You don't want to, if my child is behaving in a way that is quote unquote undesirable out in public, whatever that may be, I don't want to always be apologizing for him. I don't want to be like, oh, he's disabled, I'm so sorry. Oh, he has autism, I'm so sorry. Because that's really yucky, because it's me saying what he is hearing is your disability is bad and it's making you do bad stuff that people don't like. And for many kids, it's a privacy thing. They don't want that revealed. As the parent of a child who is visibly disabled, I don't need to say, like, hey, my kid's disabled. Cool. Because people can figure that out. And if they can't, that's fine. That's their thing. But instead of apologizing for him when he is squealing and dancing at the grocery store and simming and doing all of his things very loudly, he does many things very loudly with great enthusiasm.
Like a 10-year-old boy will.
Like a 10-year-old boy will, who is so excited about the cheese at the grocery store. And it's not actually because of the cheese, it's because of the lighting over the cheese. But people are like, wow, he really likes cheese. And I'm like, he does. Do you want to dance? And they're like, cool, let's dance. And saying, thank you for understanding, instead of apologizing, If my child's doing something wrong, like, we will all apologize. If he's not actually doing anything wrong, we've really gotten ourselves in the habits of not apologizing when he's not doing anything wrong, because I don't want him to hear, I am so sorry for you just being you. We want him to know, like, it's cool. Like, let's block the aisle in Costco for a moment because we need to dance.
It's such an important thing for all of us to really reset and think about, right? That somebody who is disabled is not succeeding in the degree to which they make their disability less visible, right? That's not the point. The point is for society to become more wide and accepting of all types of lived experience that aren't bothering anybody else.
Yes, absolutely. And I've talked to so many neurodivergent and especially autistic individuals who feel like they have had to spend or continue to feel like they have to spend so much of their life masking all of their things and all the parts of who they are. And it just sounds exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because there's this expectation. You must make eye contact. You must speak. You must respond. You must not repeat the words. You must not wear headphones. Like, what? Like, can we? No, it's fine. Like, wear your headphones. It's cool, man.
Margaret, it's an exciting news day.
An exciting news day indeed, Amy.
A few years ago, we launched our first spinoff podcast, Toddler Purgatory, hosted by the hilarious Blair Brooks and Molly Lloyd.
And guess what? Now Blair and Molly are back with their all-new podcast, Unsticking It.
You know Blair and Molly as two busy moms and actors. And somewhere between potty training and the pandemic, they both felt like they lost their creative kaboom.
In their new podcast, Unsticking It, they are going to talk about how all of us can get back to what lights us up after motherhood. Amy, I need this.
Me too. And Blair and Molly will be talking to fellow imaginative minds. We're talking actors, artists, and creators of all kinds about how we can all unstick ourselves from whatever muck we're stuck in.
Follow, subscribe, and listen to Unsticking It wherever you get your podcasts.
That's Unsticking It with Blair and Molly, because sometimes life sucks.
When it comes to raising kids, there's so much to consider. Things like, what do we feed them? When do we feed them? How do they sleep? What does it look like to raise kind kids? How does their nervous system work? How do I keep myself calm? What are my triggers? There's so much that comes into play. And we are distilling all of that information for you at Voices of Your Village podcast, where we bring experts in the field of early childhood and education and psychology and across the board so that you don't have to comb the internet for information. You get to show up and hang out and have shame-free, judgment-free conversations and insights into what it looks like to raise kind, empathetic, emotionally intelligent humans. I'm Alyssa Blask Campbell. I have a master's degree in early childhood education. I'm a mom of two, and I am walking this journey right alongside you doing this work. Come hang out with me at Voices of Your Village, and we can dive into real conversations with actionable tips.
Can we talk a little bit about when family and friends are sometimes not in the same place as you and or your kid in terms of understanding or accepting the disability? How do you make that easier as the parent?
Mm-hmm. That's a really tough one, looking at others' acceptance. The first priority is always the comfort and the safety of your child. If there are people who are making your child feel uncomfortable, unwelcome, unsafe, the priority is the child's well-being. And even if family members or friends do not like that, which there will be times when they will not like that, they're not the priority. It is emotionally very hard. And the hardest times I've had dealing with people are not strangers. Strangers tend to be great for the most part. It's people close to us who have been kind of awful, because they just can't handle how tragic this is. And, oh, this is so hard. And, oh, I feel so bad for you. And, like, the pity. And it's like, oh, my gosh. And then you're managing everyone else's fragile emotions. And you're like, can you just, like, tell me my kid has great hair? Because he has great hair. Like, I'm already managing a whole situation here. And I'm, like, cleaning vomit out of my hair. And, like, the feeding tube is over in the other room. And, like, I'm like doing all these things. And when you're just like heaping this pity on me, or you just can't handle it, I can't manage your fragile emotions in this scenario. So I think giving ourselves ourselves the grace to create boundaries, to distance ourselves when we need to, and to make it clear that in order for you to play this role, have this presence, whatever in my life, this is what I need and this is what my child needs. And if that is just too far out of your comfort zone to participate in our lives this way, like, it can be hard and it can be sad, but I need to distance myself from you for our own mental health. And so often, parenting and caregiving are two different things. And in my case, they really overlap as a parent caregiver. And mental health of the parent caregiver is a huge component of what makes this work and makes it sustainable over time. For me, that role will be full-time and lifetime. And if my child outlives me, that will be beyond my lifetime. And I need to look at things like that, that in my experience have been such a drain on my mental health, and really be protective of my child and myself, because at the end of the day, you can't control other people's reactions and things and stuff. You can share with them what you need, how you would like things to change or improve, but it's hard, but making peace with the fact that there will be people who are like, peace out, I cannot come on this journey with you. And that's hard.
You actually talk about this very specifically in the book, and I made a note of it because I thought it was refreshing and true that you, the parent, have to figure out what supports you need to do this work, who you need in your life. And were you deliberate, and are you deliberate in this book about laying out how the parent caregiver can start to figure out what other supports I need, not just my kid?
Mm-hmm. I am so incredibly deliberate about that. And part of that for me is for myself and for others, validating exactly how we are feeling and not the like, oh, you should do this, or you should make peace with this, or you should accept this, or you should not be so overwhelmed, or you should take a yoga class. You should get a massage.
Get up earlier and take some time for yourself.
Exactly. By the way, I've tried that. And then when you're dragging at 6 p.m. and you're like toothpicks in a cartoony way to like keep the eyes open, you're like, this is actually not good. Of what does actual self-care and self-preservation look like? And it absolutely can look like tackling that to-do list and the stack of paperwork and figuring out the IEP, like all of learning what all these crazy acronyms are. All of this boring stuff, we need to find a place for that that takes up a giant amount of my time and energy. But if I can't figure out how to make all of the stuff and the planning and the everything sustainable, then I will never have the mental space to say, I am going to take a yoga class. I am going to go have brunch with my friends. And it simmers as this, it can be resentment. It's certainly overwhelmed depression, like all of these things, because there's a feeling of guilt and I'm not spending enough time with my other kid, with my spouse, getting enough sleep, eating a salad, like whatever that can look like, because you're so caught in this overwhelm. And how do we, in a very real way, say like, what do I need? You know what? I need to like get that check from the insurance company so I can afford groceries. Like, that is self-care, people. And that is really important.
Kelly, one thing you talk about in this book is the difference between hard things and scary things, and sort of creating that difference for yourself, making that clear as a path forward. Tell us about that.
We all have hard things. And parents of any sort do this awful comparison thing that we need to stop doing. And of course we do, because we're people. But my hard thing is different than your hard thing. You might be like, whoa, feeding tube. Ah, that's scary. And I'm like, actually not scary at all. And he has the healthiest diet of anyone we know, because we make it in the blender. The hard isn't going to go away, and we can't escape hard things and have a life without hard things, but we can certainly take the fear out of a lot. And the fear often comes with the unknown. there certainly are some diagnoses, and especially once you start adding medical complexity into things, that can be scary. Most things are scary in our heads because of what we have built them up to be. You know, for me, disability seemed really scary because that just seemed like, oh my gosh, everything just ends because my kid's disabled. No, where was I getting that knowledge? Ignorance, that's where I was getting that knowledge. Feeding tube sounded terrifying because I had never heard of one before. And then suddenly we're hospitalized and the doctors are putting us on a surgery schedule for a feeding tube. And I'm like in tears of like, this is the worst thing ever. And it's actually not that big of a deal. And we need to figure out as humans, and by the way, this certainly applies to greater life perspective, whether that is going to the doctor or voting or whatever it is, how can we get real, reliable information that informs whether or not this is scary? Because most of the times, and especially with our children, everything seems scary. And I love, and I know you've touched upon this in one of your recent episodes about talking about the not yet. There is so much that is scary, whether or not your child is disabled, of when it comes to your kid, it all seems scary because you want all the things for them. Our older son at 17 months and change, he started walking, which is just barely before you start to quote unquote worry. But he was also talking at 10 months old, which is preposterous. So it's like, was that scary? I guess not, certainly not in the grand scheme of things. But because I had no real knowledge of disability, it all seemed scary. And I was making it so much worse because I was not in community with any real information or people who, we all know disabled people, but with people who had shared their disability with me.
Mm-hmm. And that's what the internet is so much better for, that, for finding the parents who have, whose children maybe have the exact same syndrome that isn't well understood, right? The exact same abnormality in a chromosome, things like that. It can be so useful, but how do you draw the line for yourself between useful internet searching and what's that boundary for self-care you place in yourself?
The internet search boundary for self-care, for me, I have a very high bar for what I will take in. How is it making me feel? Is it taking my energy or is it giving me energy? If I search something and they're like, your 10-year-old boy is pregnant because he has all of these symptoms, and then I spend the rest of the day in ridiculous and unfounded anxiety, you know what? That anxiety doesn't actually need to be there. And there are times when Googling helps, but so many of us at the beginning of our journey are basically handed a diagnosis and told to go home, Google, and cry, which is like the worst thing. And I literally did that. And so many of us do because we're not given a path forward and really looking at whether it is local organizations who facilitate all the services and supports for kids with your diagnosis or suspected diagnosis or friends who have kids with disabilities, like whatever it is, find out who and what are your trusted resources and lean heavily on those, because there is so much out there that we can't trust and it's just going to make our lives worse.
So well said. So we've been talking to Kelly Coleman. Her brand new book is Everything No One Tells You About Parenting a Disabled Child, Your Guide to the Essential Systems, Services, and Supports. By the way, there are a lot of us out there parenting disabled children. You ran the numbers on it and it was, you basically stopped at, there's a lot and we don't do a good job of counting, but 1 in 33 children are born with birth defects, according to the CDC, and 1 in 6 children have developmental disabilities.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you're
and
in good company.
1 in 4 adults have disabilities.
So who is the ideal reader for this book? Who do you think should, I mean, I think everybody should read this book because it's eye-opening and it's combines fun readability with really useful takeaways on every page. But who do you think is the perfect reader for this book?
I think the perfect reader for this book is any parent who is sitting there and banging their head against the wall saying, there's got to be a better way to do this. Whether that is the person with the brand new diagnosis, or like me, who's holding their baby and is like, something's going on, but nobody believes me. Or even friends I've talked to who have adult children with different disabilities who are like, oh, I didn't know that's how to figure out the social services that I should have been receiving for the last 20 years. It's all of us who just feel like, I want this to be easier. It's never going to be easy. It's never going to be fun to call your insurance company. But anybody who just wants an easier, better way to make this manageable.
Kelly's book is called Everything No One Tells You About Parenting a Disabled Child. I will put the link in the show notes so you can buy it right from where you're listening right now. But Kelly, tell our listeners where else they can find you.
Yes. So my website is kellycoleman.com, and that's KELLEY Coleman.com. And that has all of my social media and info. And I would love to hear from everyone. And I think this book is going to change lives, and it certainly would have changed my life if I had had this a decade ago.
I totally concur. This is a life-changing book, so get it if this episode is speaking to you. Everything No One Tells You About Parenting a Disabled Child. Kelly, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate you and your community.
Everybody.
It's us, Blair and Molly, your old pals from Toddler Purgatory. Two moms who are also actors, who are also creative beings, who sometimes feel stuck.
And this is our new podcast, Unsticking It with Blair and Molly. What happens when your creative spark just seems to disappear? Gone.
Poof. Bye.
See ya. What happens when life gets in the way of your creativity instead of nourishing it? That's what happened to Molly and me. We felt like the thing that drove us creatively stopped working, and impending doom had in fact impended.
Totally. So we decided to do something about it. And that was steal ideas about getting unstuck from the most creative people we can find. We talked to guests about how to break through the mucky, gluey, sticky wall that can get between you and your creativity. We hear about their journeys, their successes, their challenges, and even their bougie coffee shop orders.
And we're not just talking Bob Ross type paint on paper artists here, though we talk to them too. We're talking to actors, creative directors, dancers, and people who are working hard to be their best creative selves in a world that can sometimes feel real uncreative.
We all have something to teach each other, so let's steal their ideas together.
Join us, won't you, as we deep dive into how to unstick ourselves from the life gunk that can get in the way of our creative freedom. Pandemics, school calendars,
world events, lack of sleep. Oh, get out of their life gunk.
And let's get back to your best creative self. Subscribe to Unsticking It with Blair and Molly.
You're not going to want to miss an episode.
Unsticking It with Blair and Molly, because sometimes life sucks. Unsticking It.